Open up your Bibles, please, to 1 Timothy that we read earlier on. Verse 1 and 2 follow on from the end of the chapter that went before. But at the end of the chapter before, well, verse 12, we had the instruction to Timothy. Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, but set an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, and in purity. The tendency that others have to look down on you, you overcome by setting an example. And then Paul unpacked that, what that example looked like. And these first two verses, verses 1 and 2, really they're looking back, if you like, to chapter 4, rather than really belonging with the rest of chapter 3. Don't rebuke an older man harshly. We need at times to rebuke. We need at times to be rebuked. We've been talking, haven't we, in the last couple of Sunday mornings about the role of Nathan, the prophet, in rebuking David. And if God sends people to rebuke you, as God sent Nathan to David, then see that as his gift to you, his grace, that he won't allow you to continue in your error or your rebellion against him. But if God has sent you to rebuke, then yes, it is a serious business, but here we're to be told how it's to be done. It is to be done, but not harshly. Rather, it's to be done, what? Exhorting him. As an encouragement. As if he were your father. To do so with respect. To do so with love. And these two verses, they show really how it is that we're to relate in the church. And if you look at those verses, talking about the way in which we relate as a church, there ought to be one word that kind of springs into your mind. Exhort this older man as if he were your father. Treat this younger man as if he was your brother. This older woman as if she were your mother. And this younger woman as your sister. In the church, we're to relate as though we were family. Conveys a sense of intimacy, doesn't it? Of closeness. It would be really strange, wouldn't it, if somebody in conversation with them, they were telling you how close they were as a family. How, without fail, they saw each other every year at Christmas for an afternoon. You say, that's not actually that close a family. That's not really that intimate a relationship as a church, as Christians together. Then relating in this way as a family, what does that look like? Surely it can't just be predicated on the fact that we sit down together for an hour on a Sunday evening while some chap at the front preaches to you. That's not normally what family relationships look like, is it? No, there must be a sense of interconnectedness. There must be that relational element. And the church is to provide brothers and fathers and sons and mothers and sisters and daughters to those who don't have them. Now, we know that that's objectively true. Theologically, it's true. The Bible talks about us having a heavenly father, about us being adopted together. But just being objectively true isn't enough here. It needs to be felt to be true. It needs to be experientially true. The men and women who share this congregation with you need to feel that. And Paul now talks to a particular example of their family life together. That of how they care for widows. Quick refresher though, why is it that Paul is writing this letter? Well, it's to call the church back, isn't it, to the apostolic teaching of truth, to straighten out the way things are being done in the church. To get them to major on the main thing. To call them back to the gospel, the good news. Perhaps the reason why this chapter is needed, this first half of this chapter, they have devoted themselves so intently to social concern. And that was right, and that was needed. But they had managed to neglect and push the proclamation of the gospel to one side. Instead of being evangelistic, they had become introverted. And it seems that Paul wants to address this issue so that they can get back to their primary mission. Now, in the culture of the day, certainly a woman was kind of defined in her relationship to her husband. She was valued or important because of him. When he died, she not only lost her spouse, she didn't only lose her income, her financial security, but she lost her status, her social standing. In general, widows were desperately poor and pushed to the fringe of society. We see that. We see lots of stories in the Bible that where widows play a central role, don't we? The Greek word that is translated widow implies the sense of being bereft, of being left alone. It's an emotive term. Even in our society, women who have been widowed, women who are divorced, single mums, they are often more vulnerable. They are more likely to know hardship. How does God view that? We read at the outset, Psalm 146. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow. In Psalm 68, God is described as a father of the fatherless, the protector of widows. It's God who, in giving his law, says, don't take advantage of the widow or an orphan, because if you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. It is God who pronounces in Deuteronomy, cursed is the man who withholds justice from the foreigner or the fatherless or the widow. The one who's without home or without father or without husband, God has particular concern for them. In the New Testament, in James, James defines what does true religion look like. It is to look after widows in their distress. And you could think about the situation of the compassion we see as Jesus deals with widows in the Gospels. Think about the widow of Nain. Do you remember this? He's coming to Nain. There's a funeral procession coming out. There's this lad, dead. He's the only son of his mother, we're told. She a widow. She's lost everything. And Jesus, filled with compassion for her, you remember, raises the boy. There is a biblical example. There is a biblical command that we should care for widows, for orphans, for the foreigner, for those in need. And I suppose, as Jesus said, the poor will always be with you. There is no shortage to need. There is no limit to those who need care, is there? But there are limits to our resources. Who is it that we care for and how? Do we care for someone needy here in the congregation? Do we care for someone needy who lives in St. Brevels? What about people who live in Lydney? In Chepstow? In Sunderland? In southern Sudan? What are our responsibilities and to whom? How do we decide? Certainly it's true that our responsibility is proportionate to proximity. In other words, the closer people are to us, the greater the responsibility we have to them. Our greatest responsibilities are not to those who are closest to us. And thinking back to the opening verses, which made it very clear that we are to deal with each other as family, what about our responsibility to someone who is in need in the church? Clearly, we have great responsibility there. Well, the church at Ephesus recognized that need. And their response was, well, it seems this, they've created, I think we can say, a list of widows. Verse 9, no woman widow may be put on the list. And then they've organized practical care and financial support for them. Give proper recognition. And that proper recognition is, the language implies a sense of practical care, of financial support. But it seems to be that this system has been perhaps open to abuse. There are those, we'll talk about them in a moment, who don't really need the help. In other cases, the church is burdened, weighed down by providing indiscriminate care. Don't let the church be burdened with them so the church can help those who are really in need. So Paul, in writing to them, needs to kind of set out some principles to straighten up their priorities to redress this problem. Now, there's a commentary by a man called Simon Robertson that I found quite helpful in my thinking around this. But to work out who really needs help, who it is the church is responsible for, the church have to identify, first of all, the three groups of people that really don't need their help. And they're the ones that we're told about here. So in verse 4, we learn about those who could be looked after by their own families. If a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for them. Verse 8 tells us if someone doesn't provide for their own family, well, they've denied the faith. They're worse than an unbeliever. And verse 16 says that if there's a believing woman, if there's a Christian woman, she's got relatives who are widows, she's to take care of them. So the church wouldn't be burdened with them. It can concentrate for those who are really in need. So there are those who could be looked after by their families. Paul is saying, no, let them be looked after by their families. There are some who are kind of, I guess we describe them as being able-bodied women. They're women, perhaps they've been widowed when they were younger. And rather than seeking the support of the church, well, they're encouraged they could marry, they could bear children, they could manage their own households. Perhaps what is going on there is this. Maybe some of these women have publicly committed themselves. They say, we're not going to remarry, we're going to stay single so that we can devote ourselves to the church, to God's work. And it may even be that the church has then financially supported them in doing that. That's probably when it says don't put them on the list, that's probably what's being referenced to there. But in time, they've not unreasonably felt, actually, I want to remarry. And verse 11 and 12 then talks about those who, their desires overcome their dedication to Christ. They want to marry, and therefore they end up breaking their promise, their pledge. And maybe we get a hint of the problem that occurs in Ephesus, that some of these people having too much time on their hands, well, they end up not using the time well. They've become idlers or even gossips. Instead of doing the work they devoted themselves to, actually now they're causing an offense. So Paul is saying that group of women ought not to be supported by the church. They can support themselves. There are those who can be looked after by their families. The third group, there are people who are just taking advantage of the church. These are the ones, we see them in verse 6. They have no interest in the good news. All they're interested in is what they can get out of the church. They're self-indulgent. Paul describes them, they're living for pleasure, and they're dead spiritually, even though they're alive physically. This kind of widow, not honoring to God at all, no interest in the church or in the gospel, but just taking advantage of it. We are to be generous, but we're not to be gullible. The church has limited resources, and we're to use them well. And that requires great wisdom and sensitivity. And Paul says, look, there are these groups of women, and actually they don't need your support. You've got limited resources to support those who really do. And you must. Who is it, of course, that leads the church in provision for widows, in caring for those in need? Well, we read earlier on, didn't we, from Acts 6, where the church appoints what we call deacons to take care of this practical matter, this support of the widows. The contention arises because this group say our widows aren't being as well looked after as those. The spiritually dead woman in verse 6 is contrasted with a widow in verse 5 who is really in need and left all alone. What does she do? She puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. And maybe in reading that you're reminded of Anna, the prophetess in the temple. You know, when Jesus is brought up to the temple, we're told about this lady Anna who had been widowed. And now she continued a night and day in the temple. She's a godly woman. She's devoted herself. to this. There was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. I'm in Luke 2 now. She was very old. She'd lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage and then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying. And she it is who, coming up to them at the very moment, gives thanks to God and speaks about the child to all those who are looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem. It's a great honour in that. Well, those are some specifics from Ephesus in the first century. Paul wants the church to refocus, to get its priorities straight, not to allow their resources to be sucked up by those who have no spiritual interest, not to allow the support to be abused, to ensure the support is focused on those who really need the help. How do we apply these things to us? What principles do we draw out? First thing to say is the urgency of care. The urgency of care. Paul instructs them that they are to give proper recognition to those in need. To do something practical. And along with all the other biblical evidence that speaks about widows and about those in need, it's clear we can't shirk this. We have to take this seriously. Notice, though, that the imperative is given is about how we deal with those in need, widows specifically, within the church. That is where our instruction is given. Now, that's not to say we have no involvement with others. The fact is we're able to display love towards others. We're able to show love towards our neighbour. But that is not the church's main responsibility. Our first responsibility, our priority, is to those who are closest to us. It is within the church family. And so there will be people in our church family who will need a lift to hospital, who will need somebody to cook a meal for them, who will need somebody to sit down and chat with them over a cup of tea. Transport and food and friendship. Not particularly glamorous. Practical. The kind of things that we have a responsibility to provide for each other. You know, we have to take seriously that idea of family that we see in those opening verses. And shame on us as a church if there are men or women in the church who are lonely or hungry or cold or unable to get to a hospital appointment. And there are also needs then in our village, in the surrounding villages, in the communities we represent. And it would be a great witness if we were able to do something to help to meet those needs, wouldn't it? And that's why we collect for the food bank. It's why we host a coffee morning. It's why there are 50-odd shoe boxes packed for Christmas at the back. We face hard choices about where we spend our limited resources. We could give all of our time and our money, our energies to supply the needs around us, and we wouldn't begin to scratch the surface. So there is then, we're called to be discerning, to support where there is genuine need, and to do the maximum good with the limited resources we have. But notice too, in the instructions that Paul gives, there is a dignity to the support that Christians provide. It doesn't demean those in need. It doesn't stigmatize those in need. It encourages that they would be involved themselves. They would not merely be served, but they would serve. They would not only receive, they would also give. Look at verse 10, speaking about the kind of a widow that would be supported, is one who is what? Involved in showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. It doesn't marginalize or demean. The widow who receives the help is also devoting herself to helping others. That wonderful reciprocal thing that you see in a family. I mean, don't you have that? Don't you have a child running errands for grandma who can't do it herself, but in return, she giving things, doing him things for the child. That wonderful reciprocal relationship that ought to characterize us as a church. We can only do what God has called us to do. We can only use the means he has given us. We have to accept our limitations. You are not God. But that keeps us humble. And that drives us to pray. And that reminds us that poverty and want and suffering and disease won't actually be wiped out by our efforts or even by structural change at a governmental level, nor even by the transforming work of the gospel. Suffering and disease, want, poverty, illness and death will be made right when Jesus returns. And that is our great hope. And the promise of justice and the end to want, it will come. But it's Jesus we look to do it. That doesn't diminish our responsibility now. That doesn't mean that we can sit back and forget about it. Rather, it frees us to get on, knowing that it doesn't all hang on us. So there's the urgency of care, but also we have to see here the supremacy of proclamation. The urgency of care, the supremacy of proclamation. You see, the greatest work of the church is to proclaim the gospel. But it seems that they in Ephesus have got bogged down in this explosion in welfare. And Paul in this letter calls them to be more focused in the way they do that welfare, the way they provide that care, that social concern, more focused with what they're doing so they can get on with their greatest task, which is the proclamation of the gospel. Hence, we read again in Acts 6, where the apostle said, it's not right that we would neglect the ministry of the word and prayer for this. He's not saying it doesn't matter. He's not saying we oughtn't to show this concern or this care. He's saying we don't neglect that for this. Why is it that preaching the gospel takes priority over social action? I mean, what about the instruction that we're given to love our neighbor? Well, think of it this way. Suppose there had been a great flood in Lydney. There's been a huge storm, a great tidal surge, and Lydney is underwater. And you happen to have a boat. It's nothing fancy. It's one of those kind of big, rigid, inflatable boats with an outboard motor. It's a good boat, a strong boat. Carry plenty of stuff. It won't get swamped in waves. And you set off to Lydney to see if you can help. And so as you drive your boat through the streets of Lydney, you can see a man. Most people have been evacuated, but there's this guy he's left behind. He sat on the top of his bungalow. He's on the roof. And you can see he'd obviously missed the warnings. He'd been caught unawares. He sat on the roof of his bungalow. He's wearing his pajamas. He's got no shoes on. And the floodwater is right. And it's kind of lapping at the eaves of his house. It's coming up to the guttering. You think, well, this is terrible. This poor man, he's in a desperate situation. There he is. I've got to help him. And so you drive your boat up the street. You maneuver past the cars that are floating past and around the lampposts and you come to the house and you reach over to the man and you hand him your shoes and then you drive off. Yes, you helped the man, didn't you? You gave him your shoes. He's now sat on top of his bungalow in Lydney in his pajamas as the floodwater rises, but he's wearing shoes. You met a need. He didn't meet his greatest need. Compared to the rising flood, his bare feet seem a bit trivial, doesn't it? He needed to be rescued. You know, there are men and women and boys and girls living all around us with his greatest need. Here it is. They're perishing. They were made to know God and they don't. By going their own way, they've become enemies of God. The greatest need of every human being is this, that one day they're going to die. and they're going to come face to face with God and have to answer for their rebellion. Every selfish act, every untrue word, every proud thought, and they will be condemned to an eternity away from him. It's what we call hell. And so as Christians, we should be, we must be concerned for the people around us. We must show care and kindness for them in their need. But the greatest kindness we can show is to point out to them their greatest need. Jesus is God, born as a human baby in Bethlehem, lived 30 odd years, suffered and died in our place so that we could be forgiven, so that we could be right with God. But he didn't remain dead, God raised him to life. He's ascended into heaven, he's given the Holy Spirit to his people, and one day he will return to judge the living and the dead. That is the gospel, the good news that we are called to proclaim. And proclaiming that must be our highest priority as a church. It isn't to say that these other things we oughtn't to do. It isn't to say that they don't matter. It's to say let's get them right so that we can get on with our biggest job. It isn't loving to give someone a meal without also making sure they know that God has made a way for their spiritual hunger to be satisfied forever and that Jesus says, I am the bread of life. It isn't loving to offer someone friendship at a coffee meal morning or whatever without also offering them reconciliation to God, friendship with their creator. It isn't loving to give someone a lift to a hospital without also reminding them that one day Christ will return and that there will be no more sickness or suffering or death. And so we absolutely must. There is an imperative, there is a command here. The way we treat those in need. Specifically widows, but by implication, those in need. But it ought never to diminish our concern for their greatest need. Which is that men and women, boys and girls are needy souls before God, perishing, lost without him. Well, let's pray that God gives us wisdom and discernment and passion in this area.